There's nobody here that's afraid of anyone or anybody or anything. We have no vested interest in a career in radio. So if we get thrown off the air, it's not going to bother us a bit. Therefore, we're not going to compromise what we say to stay on the air, irregardless of the pressure that may be put upon us.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Netanyahu comes to the White House this week. Does Trump have the ability or the will to stand up to the Israel lobby? Also, the Arab Spring, a psychological warfare operation cooked up at the Rand Corporation. That's what one whistleblower says. He also believes that a UBS bank in Switzerland is the main conduit for secret funds from the West and the Gulf states to ISIS. And other Middle East terrorist groups, which means they may not be terrorists at all, just special operations by rogue states such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Kuwait. Also, our acronym prefabs. We look at passwords, last week, and this week we'll have a look at, and also last week we had a look at real privacy. Some more this week, we'll run through those for you in case there's a cyber attack. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, a chair of the Anglican Church's Marriage, Sexuality and Culture Group. She's originally from Seattle, Lisa Noland, and she's based here in Bristol. We hear why she's so concerned about what she calls the sexual revolution. Plus, this former US Army psychological warfare officer, Scott Bennett, explains which areas are most heavily targeted by his old propaganda colleagues with their mainstream media fake news. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, we pay our taxes for the government to ensure they're there in an emergency. But the cuts are about to hit Avon Fire Brigade. How will they affect what happens when we dial 999? I'm joined by outgoing Avon Brigade Secretary from the Fire Brigades Union and Vice Chair of the Southwest Region of the Union. That's Chris Taylor. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us what's the headlines on these cuts, because I know one thing I saw was that the Yate Fire Station looks like that's going to close.
Well, Yate Fire Station is not closing. I can assure your listeners of that. But what's happening is it's going to be downgraded on a night time between the between 5 in the evening and 8 in the morning.
When you say downgraded, does that mean that there will be still some presence there?
Yes. There'll be presence there, but it'll be on a part-time retained system rather than a whole-time system that they're on at the moment.
So let's face it, if there's a fire in Yate at night time, which there is probably the most dangerous fires are at night time, then there will be a longer response time.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what we was trying to get across to the politicians at the recent Avon Fire Authority meeting, that there is an effect on a response service. If it does downgrade to retained duty system, which the girls and boys on that system do a fantastic job, but the reality is that it will be a slower response standard going out to the fires than what they've already had.
So effectively, rather than having a watch of firemen or firefighters in the station ready to jump into a fire engine if something worst happens, they're at home. Is that right? And then they get called into the station. So that means that's going to take probably at least the very least 15 minutes or so longer.
Well, absolutely. There are time slots. They should be living within 5 minutes of the station, so they should be there at the station within 5 minutes. But then by the time they've got their kits on and that, again, it delays the turnout. So, yeah, you would... imagine that a full-time station would have a turnout of 2 minutes before they're out the door. With a retained one, that you're talking about 5 to 8 minutes.
Is Yate the only place that looks like it may be affected?
There are other effects of the integrated risk management plan, and that's
these cuts have always got some kind of snazzy name for them. Integrated IRSP. Sorry, MP.
Yeah, the integrated risk management plan was something that came in when the government of the day decided to cut national standards of response, and the idea behind an integrated risk management plan or an IRMP is basically to look at the risk that your area has and then respond accordingly, which is a perfectly straightforward and sensible way to do, but unfortunately up and down the country it's been touted for cuts, and there's been excuses made for cuts. And unfortunately, although the Avon Fire Service have tried their best in the past 10 years not to do that, like some of the services have, unfortunately the cuts have caught up with us because there's not enough money coming from central government.
So at the end of the day, how many are we talking about? How many different fire stations are there? I mean, when we pick up the phone, we do expect a fire engine to be there pretty quick.
Yes, if you pick up a phone, there's a number of what we call all-time duty stations, and also there are a number of retained duty system stations. And to generalise, the all-time stations are generally in the urban areas, the heavily populated areas, and the retained duty system stations are usually in the country rural areas.
Now, your press release here from the Avon Fire Service is saying, this is from the union, is saying that the service will look very different. But you see, you're painting me a picture of maybe just a few tiny minor changes that aren't really going to affect things very much.
No, it will. It will change the way the service is delivered quite dramatically. And what I mean by that is, since 2010, we've lost nearly 200 firefighters in Avon, which is quite a large number.
Out of how many, though?
Out of around about 900 firefighters, something like that. So you're talking about, I mean, what's the figures? I don't know, but you're talking about
it's over 20%. Anyway,
yeah, 25%. So around about 25% of firefighters we've lost. We've lost 30% of backroom staff who support that. And what it means in reality is the resilience of the service is dramatically affected, and also the response that the service send out is dramatically affected.
Can you give us an example?
Well,
I mean, okay, so there may not have been a lot of change with taking away those cuts. It's one of those interesting things for fire service is people are being paid to sit there and wait in case something happens. Quite often it doesn't happen.
Well, that's not entirely true, because what a firefighter does in this day and age is completely different than what it was 30, 40 years ago. The community work that we do and the educational work that we do with the general public and the community is fantastic. And that's one of the reasons why fires, as the government tried to say, that fires have reduced, so we'll reduce firefighters. But you cannot look at a responsive service in that manner, because when someone wants a fire engine, they want it there quickly. I'll just point this out to you. I'm coming to the end of a 30-year career. When I joined the job 30 years ago in 1987, for a place like Bristol, you would have to have two fire engines on site at a fire within 5 minutes of that call. The response standards, that was a national response standard for a Category A area. The response standards now for a Category A area in the Avon area is one fire engine within 8 minutes. So you can see the difference. In the old days of national standards, you had to have two appliances at that fire within 5 minutes.
Well, that's frightening me in a way. You're saying they're the old days of national standards. Are you saying now it's like a postcode lottery?
Well, you could say that. In fact, I did say that in my address to the Fire Authority. The postcode lottery is quite simple, as far as I'm concerned. The government give things to some areas, on the precepts area. For instance, if you live in one part of the country, your precept for the fire service could be £89, £90 for a standard D category house. Whereas in the Avon area, because of good management by the fire authority, I might have had in the days where we didn't have capping, that is down to £69. So there's £20 per household difference. And that is a major, major worry for me, because the government are cutting with one hand their central government money that they're giving to the fire service, and then they're not allowing you in the other hand to reap that money in any other way, because they're capping the amount of money you can take off the local taxpayers. And they're not just doing this for fire service, they do it for all kinds of public sector services that should be given and should be funded by the central government. The government, this government and the coalition government before, about austerity pledge, that austerity is not working, in my opinion. It's not working in social care, it's not working in the NHS, it's certainly not working in the fire service, and I don't think it's working in the police service or the prison service either. So we are, public sector wise, we're in a state really where this government are really pushing us to the edge of breaking point, in my opinion.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, police, prison service, hospitals, fire service, this austerity programme, I mean, we reiterate this time and time again, and there's going to be a demonstration about it tomorrow, apparently, on College Green too. It's just actually wrong-headed. You're an economist, and I asked you in the first hour what you would do about it. Can you just summarise now what chancellors need to do, because there is a lot of fudging of this issue, the debt is growing and growing, and nobody seems to know what to do about it.
Well, the obvious thing to point out is that they've had to row back on their initial ideas of cutting public services, because when the coalition first came to power, they started to put the brakes on in terms of
austerity. We know it's all the policy's changed, but now I think it's important, rather than to curse the darkness, to light a lamp and to say, this is the direction we should be heading. Can you just address that?
I'm just pointing out that they themselves,
yes, we know that,
so recognised that the austerity agenda didn't work.
Yeah, so where should we be heading?
Well, what we should be doing, don't forget, we are still subsidising the banking system. That's what's happening. The RBS is still owned by the government, etc., and that's because
that could possibly be an advantage, couldn't it? Because they actually own.
Yeah,
a bank.
But I mean, but don't forget that governments, including the former Labour government, took the view that we've nationalised the banking system, but we haven't nationalised it.
Martin, I'm asking you to look forward. Yeah, not
looking.
Back,
looking. Analyse, I'm trying to look forward, but you keep sort of batting the ball back to me. That you've got to change your perspective. Public expenditure is not a waste. Having a decent fire brigade that can actually do its job is not something that you can actually afford to cut back.
I mean, look,
it doesn't make sense either from the point of view of public safety, but even in terms of things like the economy. If you cut public expenditure and sack public sector workers, you are gradually grinding the economy down.
We know this, yeah, but we've got examples from around the world. For example, in 1990 in Russia, they had a complete economic collapse with basically people having to go to the country to grow food. You know, it really was horrendous. In Iceland, for example, they've also turned their economy around. So aren't there any lessons we can learn from these other countries?
Well, in Iceland, of course, they kicked out the previous regime and they locked up their bankers. In Russia, what happened was the pro-Western elite that ran the country were kicked out, and a more sensible set of people were brought in who didn't regard privatisation as the be-all and end-all. I mean, we really got to go back to common sense policies that we used to have back in 1987 and before. You know, we used to know how to manage things, and we've kind of taught ourselves not to do it. I mean, we used to know that the balance between the public and the private sector is not a question of ideology. It's just what you've got to do if you're going to have a sensible setup.
Okay,
and we've given that up over 30 years.
Here's a bit of blue sky thinking. What about writing all that debt off, since it can't be paid?
Well,
back?
It will be written off in the crash. That's what's going to happen. There's going to be a crash. There's a bubble now, and it's going to crash. This is what we should have been talking about instead of Brexit. Brexit's a side issue. When Monte dei Paschi Bank, the oldest bank in the world, crashes in Italy, it is crashing as we speak.
Well, they keep trying to prop it up.
Well, yeah, they keep trying to prop it up. Eventually, that will work through the system into the City of London, which will then cause a further crash. Now, what should be happening is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, all the political parties should be talking about, what are we going to do about the next crash? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? But, of course, The mainstream doesn't talk like that. The economy's fixed. We're now talking about how we're going to redistribute wealth from this way or that way or the other. We're going to, we want a smaller state, a bigger state. We're still not facing up to the fact that the banking system is bust. Most of public expenditure goes on propping up the banking system. That's what's been going on all along. And that's why we've got no money for fire brigades, debt collect, bin collection, whatever.
Debt but collectors.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, anyway, look, Martin, you've had a good go there, a good stab at telling us where to go. We're joining us is Chris Taylor, listening to all of this. I don't know what you make of it, Chris. But look, can you give us some, because this is what I think many people out there are concerned about, is when basic services that we pay, we expect through our taxation, you were saying £70 a year. I mean, that's a good deal, isn't it? I think that's probably the best bit of everyone's council tax that they're paying out there. How is this actually, can you point to examples of how the cutbacks over the years, I mean, you've illustrated that we've had some quite serious reduction in targets and things like that, have actually affected your ability to do your job?
Well, the ability to do the job, I mean, the job has changed over the last 30 years, and you'll see every day of the week pictures of emergency service workers doing one thing or another. For instance, let's talk about the floods that we've had recently and the bad floods in 2007. The fire service do not get paid for doing that work. That is not part of their job. But we do that work. And the government have never funded us for that work. It's only recently that road traffic accidents have been funded by the government as part of our daily job. And that, hence we are now a fire and rescue service rather than a fire brigade. So these things have evolved, and all the different things that we do. We have terrorist alert groups for in cases of emergencies like the Mumbai cases and things. With all this sort of stuff that is going on, but the fire service and the firefighters are expected to do, learn, and deliver to save the communities and to protect the communities. And that's what it's all about for a firefighter. It's about protecting the communities. We're doing now more medical response work to help our colleagues in the ambulance service. They're collaborating with the police force by moving to Edge Quarters at Avon and Somerset Police. All these things are being done to save money for the different services. From my point of view, from where I stand on the political agenda, you should have an efficient, safe, responsive fire service, likewise ambulance service, likewise police service. And the problems that we're getting at the moment is because of lack of central government funding. There's no two ways about that, in my opinion. And what we've tried to do last week to the local politicians is to reiterate to those local politicians that it's down to them to talk to their parties, their MPs, to get it through to government's heads in Westminster that it's not working. The way they're doing things is not working anymore. They need to fund public services, the fire service, sufficiently so that they don't have to bring ridiculous ideas like, well, you can raise council tax by 5% just to cover social care. I mean, what kind of management is that? What kind of managing the country is just saying, all right, we'll react to the social care problem. We'll let you charge the ratepayer another 5%. That's money that should come from central government.
I think they call it fire brigade management, don't they?
Well, yes, yeah, it would do, yeah.
Anyway, a couple of the changes which have been voted through by the authority last Friday, that's the 10th of February. What is the authority?
The Fire Authority.
The Fire Authority.
The Avon Fire Authority is made up of councillors from the four unitary authorities in the old Avon county area.
Okay, and so it means that apparently the special, I mean, you can tell us maybe a bit more about it, specialist aerial appliances that are used for rescues from high-rise flats. Watch out, anyone, if you're in a high-rise flat, you're being cut, yeah? Will no longer be guaranteed for mobilisation in the event of an emergency. Also, a heavy rescue special fire engine in Avonmouth that's used in serious road collisions, I imagine on the M5 and M4, will no longer have a dedicated round-the-clock crew. So this is two massive changes, actually.
That is massive changes, to be honest. And it is a change that could affect people. The There's two ways of crewing a specialist fire appliance. And what we call by a specialist fire appliance is that's not the fire engine that goes out to put a fire out. That's a specialist vehicle to help firefighters do their job.
Something that can reach halfway.
Absolutely,
block of flats.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that does have to
absolutely,
be called a specialist,
yeah,
doesn't it?
And the facts are that we have them what we call primary crewed, or we did have them what we call primary crewed, and that is two dedicated fire officers on that appliance. What they have to do now, unfortunately because of the cuts, is that two firefighters from an ordinary fire engine will have to jump onto that specialist appliance and follow the fire engine out. Now that's all good and well, but if that fire engine is already out, that means that vehicle's not available. So if that fire engine's already out and doing other work or on another fire or another call, then that specialist appliance is not available. So it is a problem. It will drag out response times for the specialist appliance to get to incidents. It will delay possibly the opportunity for someone to get saved from a high-rise block of flats. And that's the reality of the fire service today, I'm afraid. And that's not just here. That's all around the country, unfortunately. That's what's happening. And that's because of central government cuts, unfortunately.
Well, this downgrading in Yate is I don't know how much it's going to cost, but £1 million, apparently, is being spent on some sort of investigation into bullying at Avon Fire and Rescue. So what's that all about? Or can you tell us a bit about the background of that?
Well, I can't really comment on a lot of the intricacies of it. The facts of it is that it's a nonsense. The view of the Fire Brigade Union is an absolute nonsense that Brandon Lewis, who's the Fire Minister, is sending in an inquiry team into something that has been caused by a disgruntled ex-member of the fire service who was at a very high senior level and had to and left. The facts of the matter is that I can assure you from my position as the brigade secretary in Avon, there is not a culture of bullying, and it's an absolute waste of public taxpayers' money to send someone in to have a look at this. If it does cost £1 million, that quote has actually come from the BBC. That hasn't come from any official source. At the Fire Authority meeting on Friday, the chair was asked how much it was going to cost, and he said he hadn't been told as yet. But yes, the taxpayer of the Avon area, the Greater Bristol area, Bath, Weston, they will have to foot the bill for that. And I can assure you, it is an absolute waste of time and public money. And it's in this time of cuts and austerity, it beggars belief that the Fire Minister has got to do this. This incident, I can assure you, has been investigated 3 times already, and there's been nothing whatsoever in the accusations on the 3 inquiries. So it's just another inquiry that will find the same answers as what the others did, in my opinion, and that's a waste of public money.
Do you think the Fire Brigade Union is actually up to defending the service for us, the public?
We are. The Fire Brigade Union, since its inception, which is an hundred years old next year, we celebrate 100 years as a trade union next year. And I can assure you, it's the professional voice of the fire service, from the Fire Services Act all the way through, going all the way up to the present day. We've always been there to try and get better conditions, not only for our firefighters, better equipment, and but only for the public safety as well. We will continue to do that. As long as there's a fire brigade, there will be a fire brigade union, in my opinion, and let's hope it stays an independent union as well. But just for your listeners to know, we've lost 10,000 firefighters since 2010 across the country. 10,000. Now, some people, that's a fifth of the all firefighters across the country since 2010.
I mean, the implication, I mean, you've talked about 25% less firefighters here in Avon.
Absolutely.
The implication is that there were too many in the first place.
That's a quote that you would get from the Fire Minister. There's less fire, so we don't need so many firefighters. I can assure you that a safe brigade needs 9 firefighters to attend a fire. And when I mean a fire, I mean a house fire or a compartment fire. That is the recognised safe numbers of firefighters to be there. Now, on a fire appliance, you should have 5 on one, which we call the rescue appliance, and 4 on the other. That gives you 9. At this moment in time, I'm afraid up and down the country, you're lucky to get 5 on one of those appliances. You're lucky to get 9 firefighters at a fire within a reasonable length of time.
Are you affiliated to the Labour Party again, or is it recently since Jeremy Corbyn became leader?
Yes, the union did reaffiliate to the Labour Party last year's conference. And to be honest, that's part of because of the way that the Labour Party's gone from right to left of centre, where it should be, in my opinion. And hopefully people will see that Jeremy Corbyn is doing a good job going forward, and they give him a chance for his policies to work.
Yeah, but a lot of his MPs don't agree with him, do you? In fact, someone would say that they are tried to do a coup against him last year.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that the masses of the Labour membership soon threw that one out, didn't they? It's an unfortunate thing that people, when they get to Westminster, seem to live in a bubble, and they don't seem to realise what's happening outside of that bubble. Jeremy's had total support from the membership, I think, and it's about time that they all got doing the job that they should be there to do, and that is to fight this government on their policies.
Now, you're outgoing FBU Avon Brigade Secretary. Who's taking over from you?
Well, there's an election going on at the moment, but hopefully it'll be my chair at the moment, Gary Spindler. I'm hoping that he will get the nomination, then we can move forward, hopefully. Gary's got a few years left to do, and hopefully he can move forward in the way that we've been moving over the last 14 years.
And as someone who's leaving the job, what legacy do you think you'd like to passed on to people taking over from you, firefighters in the future?
We haven't had recruitment in Avon for, I think, 8 to 9 years now, and I've been told by the chief that they're having new recruits this coming year. That will be a breath of fresh air, I think, because when I joined, you always like to see the new recruits come through, and you used to get new recruits every year, and hopefully that will be the case. There's been a tragic loss in the judiciary this week, where we've been told that our case for the pensions has been turned down. Hopefully there will be enough there for us to appeal in terms of firefighters being expected to work till they're 60 on the front line. Is absolutely ridiculous, and I can assure you of that. And it is a sad day that the judiciary didn't give us what they give themselves, if you like, in terms of a settlement to that employment
tribunal. So how's that going to actually affect the firefighters now and the new recruits?
Well, the way it affects people is that simply, as you get older, it gets harder to do the physical tasks that you're doing. And no one's saying that, you know, when you look at different roles within the fire service, that different levels of fitness might be there. But the facts are that they're expecting a firefighter on a fire engine to work till they're 60 years of age. To me, that has a knock-on effect as well, because obviously we like to be diverse and have female firefighters coming through as well. And some of our female colleagues have spoken to me and saying that they're very doubtful that they'll be able to keep that level of fitness up till they're 60. And it is a problem. Brandon Lewis has made a speech which says that there should be more diversity within the fire service, yet they're putting rules in place that will hinder that sort of thing, because they're making cuts, so we're not being able to employ people, and they're obviously setting ridiculous targets for ordinary firefighters who sit on the fire engines to work until they're 60 years of age.
Well, Chris Taylor, you're the Avon Brigade Secretary, Fire Brigades Union and Vice Chair South West Region. Have a very happy retirement. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tony. Thanks a lot.
Now, Martin, we have a couple of bombings yesterday, one in southern Pakistan and in Baghdad. It almost seems like the news people are putting them in pairs now so that we don't realise or we don't see that they're so... incredibly, this is almost becoming normalised, isn't it? In Baghdad, 50 people die. In Pakistan, another 50 people die. So they do it in one bulletin. Oh, 100 people die today in bomb attacks.
Well, I remember reading about this yesterday and thinking how sad it was that we've become absolutely inured now to the fact that there are going to be bomb attacks. It was a bomb attack on a Sufi shrine in Pakistan and on a Shia, I think it was a car auction in Baghdad. And that's a result of our warmongering policies over many, many years.
Well, why do you blame us?
Why do I blame us? Well, we can discuss later who really finances ISIS. We discussed that. You hinted at the top of the hour that we might discuss that. But don't forget that the militant Islamic movement that has emerged, which ostensibly carries out these atrocities, was trained, armed, and directed by Western intelligence services from the 1980s onwards in Afghanistan, which has now caused knock-on problems in Pakistan, which have been going on for decades. And, of course, there were no car bombs in Iraq before we invaded in 2003. There hardly any.
I noticed nobody who was talking to Tony Blair about remaining or remoaning or remaniacs today. Nobody seemed to say, well, how have you managed to skip jail, Tony? Because you should be in jail. You're a war criminal. They were all just, nobody seems to ask him these tough questions.
Well, no, because, basically he's beyond that, and so is George Bush, and so is lots of other people.
And it doesn't make you wonder.
We shouldn't just pick on Tony Blair. I mean, Tony Blair was...
Well, it's just because he's been in the news today.
Well, indeed, but, there's lots of other people who should be in jail. The people who set up al-Qaeda in the 1980s, that's Margaret Thatcher, by the way, and Ronald Reagan. They set it up. They'll be retired military personnel from Britain who were involved in those in setting up Al Qaeda. They've certainly not been prosecuted, have they? They're talking in Northern Ireland now about the question of what they're going to do with these investigations that are still ongoing. And James Brokenshire, the Northern Ireland secretary, is saying, well, the police seem to be concentrating too much on the army and they're trying to rewrite history. Now, the fact is that British military personnel have been involved in terrorism for decades, and not a single one of them has gone to prison. Not even Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who the head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir John Stevens, definitely fingered as behind the Force Research Unit, which was involved in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. He is actually on a pension. We are paying his pension. And I presume he's also still active in the privatised military industry.
Okay, Donald Trump this week accused Iran. This is as Netanyahu came to visit him, the Israeli Prime Minister, came to visit him in the White House. He accused Iran of seeking to develop nuclear weapons.
Well, there's no evidence for that whatsoever, as we know. But there's been all sorts of... But I have to make this point. If Iran was to develop nuclear weapons, it would be a perfectly straightforward response to Israel's possession of over 200 nuclear warheads, completely illegally. They haven't signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And if Britain, who doesn't have any enemies that want to attack us with nuclear weapons, is allowed to have nuclear weapons, why the hell isn't Iran? Although the Iranians themselves, because of their religious beliefs, don't believe in the possession of nuclear weapons. Well, and in a sense, they're right. There's no point having them.
Let me just point out, because a programme called The Cook Report, the episode Dirty Bomb, which aired on Tuesday evening, the 13th of July 1993, in that programme, Roger Cook investigated the availability of former Soviet weapons-grade plutonium and thermonuclear weapons on the Russian black market. He was offered, all filmed by a hidden camera, both weapons-grade plutonium, which was tested by Minatom, which is the Russian Atomic Energy Authority, and thermonuclear weapons from an SS-20 ballistic missile and a complete missile all crated up. Now, these SS-20 contain MIRVed warheads, which are each 150 kiloton hydrogen bomb. So if Roger Cook was offered these in 1993 and filmed the whole thing and transmitted it, a programme which was later apparently wiped by Carlton TV, Surely the Iranians and others could quite easily get hold of these on the black market in the early 1990s.
All right, well, 2 points. First of all, the warhead is no use at all unless you've got a missile to put it on.
Well, that's, and he's talking about an SS-20 missile system.
But I mean, the Iranians have got more advanced missiles than the SS-20 now equipped for non-nuclear warheads. Okay? So they've got missiles. But they're entitled to have missiles. There's no rule against them saying, no, we've got missiles. Are we not entitled to have missiles? They're entitled to have missiles. We're entitled to have them. They're entitled to have them. There is no evidence, not a shred of evidence, that the Iranians bought any missiles.
Okay, hang on, Martin, because...
Why are you saying the Iranians have bought these missiles?
If Roger Cook, the reporter, can get access to these SS-20s, each of which, I say, has three warheads, the range is several thousand miles... Mm-hmm. Then surely any state in the world or secret service is going to have access if Roger Cook can get it.
But in that case, why pick on the Iranians? It could be the Saudis.
Yes.
Okay, so but why the Iranians?
Well, the point being here that the Iranians are just one country who could have got their hands on these nukes.
Well, in other words, Ukraine. there's a real problem here with nuclear proliferation, but it's not related to Iran at all, is it? Iran is just another country that might have bought some weapons. There's plenty of repressive countries in the world which might have bought those weapons. Many of them, I mean, I'd mentioned Saudi Arabia, because they're friends of the Israelis, might supply them with a nuclear weapon. And they might even use it on Iran. And then if you were the Iranian general staff, you might think, well, we might need stuff. Now, in actual fact, the Iranians have said all along, we haven't got them. The North Vietnamese, or the Vietnamese as they now are, they haven't got them either. And they were threatened with nuclear attack by Nixon and Kissinger during the war. And they turned around and said, go on then, attack us. You can nuke us if you like, but you know what? You're bluffing. We're going to defeat you on the ground, and General Giap and the Vietnamese army did defeat the Americans on the ground. They thrashed them, and the Americans didn't dare to use nuclear weapons because they just didn't dare. And ultimately, nuclear weapons don't protect you. If you're going to use, anybody who uses nuclear weapons is setting off on an uncontrollable escalation situation. So if any country was to use nuclear weapons, other countries would start using theirs. Actually, so in other words, they're irrelevant to the military balance.
The private military company Blackwater advertised on their website that we can run and win a nuclear war.
Well, that's their delusion. They haven't done it. They haven't done so, have they? That's just their sales pitch. I'd rather have General Giap than Eric Prince. Eric Prince has never won anything. General Giap thrashed the United States of America using conventional methods.
So, is it wrong?
As they deserve.
Is it wrong then for Trump to accuse Iran of seeking to develop nuclear weapons?
He's got no evidence. There's no evidence whatsoever. There's never been any evidence. What Trump should be saying to Netanyahu is, hang on a minute, you've got nuclear weapons, which you stole from us. And you actually stole our nuclear secrets and sold them to the Russians. Jonathan Powell was put in prison for doing exactly that. Now, ultimately, we might say to the Israelis, who we know possess nuclear weapons, through subterfuge, we say, no, you put those nuclear weapons, you give us all of them, all of your warheads, or we're going to invade Israel and we're going to put you under occupation until you hand over those nuclear weapons.
The Israelis neither confirm nor deny that they've got any nuclear weapons.
We know that they've got them. We know that they're lying. And in fact, what we could say, and in actual fact, there's on the statute book in the United States of America, it's very clear. Any country which has got nuclear weapons, which is not supposed to have them, think Israel, we're not supposed to do any kind of aid, trade, or any kind of business with them, which is why they don't why they deny that they've got them, or won't confirm or deny. But everybody knows that Dimona, Mordecai Vianu exposed it, they've got them. Now, you could argue that the United Nations, the Russians and the Americans together, should invade Israel and say, you hand over those nuclear weapons, or we're going to occupy your country and we're going to take them off you.
Well, you just mentioned Vanunu there. It was interesting that the Sunday Times published that, the Insight team, that story about Vanunu, and then Rupert Murdoch took it over and sacked all the best journalists and photojournalists from the Sunday
Indeed.
Times.
So when we're talking about nuclear weapons, let's talk about somebody who has got them, the Israelis. And Martin von Krevelt, who is a defence intellectual, I think they call him in Israel, he said, what our enemies have got to understand is that we've got nuclear weapons. And that goes for all the countries in Europe. If they try and tell us what to do, we can attack Rome and Berlin. He said that. That's on the record.
The other thing is, with the Roger Cook programme, people may wonder whatever happened to Roger Cook, who's not very well at the moment, I understand. Thoughts and prayers are with him. But Roger, as part of his programme, he had a sting campaign against that programme in 2000 in the News of the World, which then shut that programme down. Effectively, it was taken off the air and it's never come back. But again, that's a Murdoch operation that shut Roger Cook down.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, lots of phony scares are being used to scare us. What about the Iranians with nuclear weapons? And the real problems of people with nuclear weapons are not even covered because we don't do the investigative journalism anymore that we used to do.
It almost sounds like Rupert Murdoch's working directly for the Israelis to shut down investigations.
He's pretty pro-Israel, and he's also got shares in the company which is going to develop the oil and gas in the Golan Heights.
Is this Genie Energy, by any chance?
Yes, that's right. Although it's completely illegal because the Golan Heights are occupied illegally by the Israelis.
Just tell us a little bit about the history of the Golan Heights. Wasn't it 1967 that they were taken over?
It was the 73 war.
I thought the 73 war was to take them back.
All right, well, yeah, you may be right. You may be right.
Yeah.
But the point is that the Golan Heights are officially part of Syria. And, of course, the Golan Heights are now being used by the Israeli Defence Force to supply and support the al-Nusra Front, who are operating against the Syrian Arab army in that region. And there's photographs of them taking people, jihadi fighters, in and giving them medical attention and also supplying them with weapons and other things. Now, in other words, the Israelis and the Western powers are the supporters of the al-Nusra Front in Syria, and they have been from the very beginning. Meanwhile, we're told we've got to go to war to defeat the al-Nusra al-Qaeda Front, but at the same time we're arming and training them, and our Israeli allies are arming and training them. I think that's a good... I mean, the Israelis are really reaching a position now where you could say, A, you shouldn't really be recognising the United Nations as an independent state because you're not fulfilling your obligations as an independent state, and secondly, you've got nuclear weapons, you're not supposed to have them. Maybe it's time for us to go to war with you unless you give up your nuclear weapons, because you're a threat not just to the Arab world, you're a threat to us, and maybe it's time for us to sort that out.
Well, I'm guessing that wasn't the conversation that took place in the White House this week.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Benjamin Netanyahu. So let's have a listen now to Trump as part of that joint conference, really talking about US policy towards Israel, particularly on whether he thinks a one or two state solution would be a good idea, and also on the shifting of the capital, which would really be the US embassy moving, and all other embassies, I imagine, following from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best. As far as the embassy moving to Jerusalem, I'd love to see that happen. We're looking at it very, very strongly. We're looking at it with great care, believe me. And we'll see what happens. Okay?
Martin, I suppose the one or two state solution, this is an old chestnut here, but he's saying, look, I think it's just up to the Palestinians and the Israeli government to decide.
Except that the Palestinians have said that you're not asking what we think at all, are you? I mean, the official Palestinian position is that they still want a two-state solution. That's the al-Fatah position. Hamas are saying, well, maybe it's too late for a two-state solution. Maybe we're just going to have to deconstruct the state of Israel, full stop. And, of course, you could then have a one state, which would be called Israel-Palestine, with one citizenship, in which the Arabs would have a majority, and it wouldn't be a Jewish state. The Jews would be a minority within that state. And, of course, when you've got an Arab majority within that one state, they can then have an immigration policy similar to Trump's, where we're saying no Jews from outside this can come in here because you've got too many people here already.
What about moving the capital, though?
Well, that's
Well, this really is controversial,
isn't
it? That's
provocative.
Because the whole idea originally was that East Jerusalem would be Arab. The Arabs were pretty much kicked out in the 67 war. At least the military, the Syrians and the Jordanians and the Egyptians, for example, were kicked out in the 67 war. So it looks as if Trump is supporting the idea of Jerusalem being a Jewish capital, which in a way, I mean, surely the Jewish people, for as Netanyahu would say, for thousands of years have been wanting this.
Well, I'll just point out that in 1948, the State of Israel was recognised on the understanding that the capital will be Tel Aviv. Now, in other words, if you don't want to recognise that was the understanding in 1948, if you change that, then you lose your right to be represented at the United Nations. Kosovo isn't represented at the United Nations, Crimea isn't represented at the United Nations, Catalonia isn't, Scotland isn't, Israel could be de-recognised. If you don't play by the rules, you're going to be de-recognised. And that's what that we say that to everybody else all over the world. There is no independent Tamil state in the north of Sri Lanka. There's all these things that all these rules apply to everybody. There's no independent Kashmir inside India. And we could say, well, on the basis of your professed position, which is that you don't want to accept all the rules and regulations, including where your capital is, maybe Israel should be de-recognised. And beyond that, I would go so far as to say that we may be in a position where we're eventually going to have to go to war with Israel because we're not happy with their positions.
Okay, what about the sacking of Michael Flynn, National Security Advisor? We heard about this time last week because he was definitely an advocate for, in fact, he was so enthusiastic to have a rapprochement with Russia that he was chatting to the ambassador before he'd even been appointed, apparently.
Are you asking me about this? Oh, well, I think this is all. What's happened here is that the only progressive point in Donald Trump's platform was that he was going to talk sensibly with the Russians. And, of course, Flynn's resignation, it's a forced resignation, really. The FBI bugged the phone call, and all he did was saying, we'll chat when we're... Because don't forget, by that stage, Trump had already won. He didn't win the most votes, but he'd won the rigged electoral system inside the US. It's perfectly reasonable for him to chat to the Russian ambassador. But, of course, this has been used as an excuse to get rid of him. I mean, I'm no friend of Flynn's. He's one of the people that was saying we've got to go to war with Iran. So, in many ways, the fact that he's been thrown under a bus is probably quite good from an Iranian point of view. But the fact is that Trump's being told we're not doing that, we're doing this, and he's gone along with it because he's basically a puppet of the military-industrial complex and the Zionist lobby, just as the previous presidents have been. And he's no different. He's slightly more dangerous because he's more belligerent, but not really that much more dangerous. He just comes out with stuff in public that people used to say in private. And the reality is that we've got a very dangerous administration, both in Israel and in the US, which are dead set on war. And, of course, they may get what they want, but they may not like it when they get there.
Yeah, I mentioned it at the top of the hour, the Arab Spring, as part of Dialect next Tuesday lunchtime. There's I found it interesting anyway, interview with a guy called Scott Bennett, who's a former psychological warfare officer. Now, Martin, one of the things he uncovered as part of his work was the terrorist bank accounts at UBS in Switzerland. And it was struck me during the week, because I put out a scan, actually, of part of Milton Shulman, his book, Marilyn, Hitler and Me, which was published in the 1990s, contains a whole chapter on the kidnapping or the rescue, some would say, of Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, from Berlin in 1945. And he describes the whole fight, really, in a way, to get this book finally published in the 1990s, written by John Ainsworth Davis. He was a commando involved in this raid to get Bormann out. It was striking for me, well, what Scott Bennett was saying was about the crucial role of UBS Bank in Switzerland back in the Second World War in helping finance the Nazi gold, basically a Nazi recrudescence after the Second World War, and today the money's coming from mostly from the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, but including the US as well, he believes, and then going to ISIS and to fund these Takfiri groups in the Middle East, particularly in Syria and in Iraq.
Well, anybody who pays attention knows that this is what's going on. Fundamentalist Sunni terrorism has been used as a tool of Western policy since the 1980s. Everybody admits that they used to do it, but then they say, but we lost control of Al-Qaeda. Now, I don't believe that for a minute. The Al-Qaeda groups operating, or affiliated groups operating inside Syria, have intimate, practical military links with the Israeli Defence Forces and with the Turkish Defence Forces and with British and American Defence Forces. The Iranians know that. The Russian general staff know that. Those who follow these things and who listen to this show over the last 8 years will know that. But I'm afraid the vast majority of the public are blissfully unaware that they're being lied to by criminals and terrorists.
So let's have a listen now to Scott Bennett. And I'll put a link up on the show page to this fascinating tale by Milton Shulman. It's just a whole chapter. In fact, it's his memoirs. He was a Canadian-born Jewish film critic in London and theatre critic for many years for the Evening Standard. But then he played a great part in getting this book finally published. The thing I found so fascinating about much of this, though, Martin, is that at the time that this book was published, there was a what you would probably call a spoiler book published, which was called The Search for Martin Bormann. At the same time, which was all about how you they searched for him, but they never found him because he died just outside the bunker. And then also since then, we've had these books, Grey Wolf, there's various other ones, Jerome Corsi has written one as well, which purport not that Martin Bormann survived, that Hitler survived and lived for many years in Argentina, etc., etc.
Well, I don't know. These do sound like spoiler books to me. I think the evidence suggests that Bormann was rescued by a British team, and then John Ainsworth Davis wrote the book about the rescue of Bormann.
Yeah, well, he also had corroborating letters from Winston Churchill. He had corroborating letters from Ian Fleming, who was also involved in this raid, and he also had a corroborating letter from Louis Mountbatten as well, who was also. So, I mean, it's very difficult to refute this, but there were still big attempts to, and many of the publishers pulled out at the last minute because they wouldn't publish the book.
Well, that's right, because in actual fact, when NATO was founded in the 1940s, the Nazi intelligence structure was taken over lock, stock and barrel, and basically integrated into NATO's planning and command at that stage.
It was key to get Bormann, because the Swiss basically said to the British, look, if you want access to all this massive loot from the Second World War, you need to have the signatory. You must have Bormann himself.
Indeed. And, of course, at that stage, NATO began, from the very beginning, as a clandestine organisation working with former Nazis. And that's why they've carried out these Nazi propaganda, psychological warfare techniques with such gusto, including, you know, false flag attacks, supporting jihadi terrorists and then claiming to be against them and all the rest of it. This is all from the Nazi psychological warfare playbook.
Scott Bennett's book is called The Shell Game, which is all about what he discovered as a psychological warfare officer about terrorist funding, which was then ignored by the media in the US and by the politicians over there. But you can read it if you want, and we'll hear now from him. This is Scott Bennett talking about the Arab Spring and how when he was working at the RAND Corporation, it was a psychological operation. They cooked up there.
The Arab Spring was just one big psychological warfare product engineered by the CIA. I was there at the RAND Corporation when they were planning it, so I can say it with absolute authority. I can also say I've interviewed people like James and Joanne Moriarty, who were in Libya as Americans, and provided people like Michael Flynn and the CIA with all of the intelligence they needed that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were state funders with Hillary Clinton of all of these mercenaries to come into Libya, overthrow Gaddafi, steal the gold, steal the natural resources, base an Israeli base up in the mountains. And since then, we've had the fall of Libya and millions upon millions of Africans and Muslim Islamic people flood up into Europe. So the European invasion by the Muslim population is really the fruit of the American policy and the British policy under Cameron, as well as Tony Blair, and the French policy under Sarkozy. But there are some striking examples of treason and cover-up that should be examined, such as the fact that American politicians, and I think European politicians, were paid $10 million to appear and give positive comments and take photographs with the rebels. And that $10 million came from the $500 billion that was stolen from the Libyan economy. Libya was described as a bank, as a country, but it was really just one single autonomous bank. It was not connected, you know, to any of the globalist banks, the Rothschild banks, and the tentacles of some of these organizations through the Council of Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergs and others.
So he's talking about Libya as a giant bank that was just sort of, this sounds like almost like a hostile takeover rather than taking over a country.
Well, that's right. They were basically trying to set up the Libyan gold dinar because they had got big gold reserves which had all been stolen, and they were going to create alternative currency set up to the one dominated by the dollar.
I don't know if you
noticed
what he said there is an Israeli camp up in the mountains facilitating the overthrow of Gaddafi.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. They're working very closely with the al-Nusra Front just over the border in Syria from the Golan Heights, which they're occupying illegally, as the Syrians well know.
OK, we're going to have to skip the prefabs thing, folks. We'll do a proper job for you next week on the last show before I go away, because I'm off to New Zealand during March with Kevin Carr here, who will be here next week. But a couple of final stories. Paris riots to 20 no-go zones in as riot violence spreads across France, really emanating from Paris. Is we back to 68 again, Martin?
No, you've got the same sort of problems we've had in this country in 2011, which is very disadvantaged youth are rebelling against police brutality. And, of course, they don't always rebel in a civilised fashion.
So, yes, of course, they won't be doing that. But why is the significance politically in France? We've got elections coming up this year, haven't we?
Well, it may be that somebody is trying to manipulate this situation, but I'm afraid the discontent that it represents has been festering for decades.
Are the French more likely to do this sort of thing than the British? Their temperament different? Or what?
Well, the kind of rioting that we're seeing here is not by students. It's by unemployed, disenfranchised urban youth.
OK, what do you make of the assassination this week, apparent assassination of Kim Jong-nam, who openly criticised the North Korean regime? Well, they say he did. But why, if he has been assassinated by the North Koreans, would it have been done in Kuala Lumpur? That sounds a bit strange, where they couldn't control the body, etc.
Well, I do not know is my simple answer to that. But of course, they did fire their rocket into the Sea of Japan while Trump was schmoozing with Shinzo Abe, so because they knew that was the way to get some attention, like a 3-year-old.
Apparently, this chap was smothered by a woman in a miniskirt. She put a cloth up to his face, possibly some sort of nerve gas in the cloth. What on earth could this be?
Well, I don't know, Tony, but the Malaysian police should investigate thoroughly. Don't forget that Malaysia has often been the target for Western...
But, I mean, what do you make of them saying it's North Korea that's done it? It just doesn't seem to make sense
to me.
Well,
it's possible that the North Koreans have done it, but if you don't investigate the event, it could be that somebody's done it to discredit the North Koreans, the South Koreans, perhaps, the Americans. You've got to carry out a police investigation.
OK, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. Our show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain tomorrow, 10 a.m. till 12, and Danny Lopsch at 8 on Sunday evening. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the White House has denied reports President Trump's considering using troops as part of a clampdown on people in America illegally.
There is no effort to utilize the National Guard to round up unauthorized immigrants. I don't think you can be any clearer than that.
That's Press Secretary Sean Spicer responding to claims up to 100,000 military personnel could be mobilised. The Associated Press news agency says the idea has been floated in a leaked memo. Tony Blair has been criticised for urging pro-Europeans to rise up and persuading those who voted to leave the EU they were wrong. In a speech in London, the former Prime Minister claimed people voted without knowing the terms of Brexit. The driver of a bin lorry which crashed and killed 6 people in Glasgow has admitted reckless driving in a separate incident. Harry Clark was caught driving a car 9 months later, despite having had his licence revoked. The UKIP leader has apologised to his party's members for comments on his website about the Hillsborough disaster. Paul Nuttall had claimed close friends were among the 96 Liverpool fans who died in the tragedy, which he has since admitted is not true. But he's dismissed speculation that he lied about being at the game in 1989.
I take the blame for the fact that I failed to check what was put up on my website in my name. That is my fault. I apologise. But I do not apologise for what is a coordinated, cruel, and almost evil smear campaign.
Unilever has rejected a takeover bid from the owner of Philadelphia Cheese and Heinz.